Hello and welcome to episode 60 of Tabletop Game Talk, a show where we talk about tabletop games of all types. I'm one of your hosts, Josh.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Kitty.
Today we're talking about ancient games. These are games that have been around since the beginning of time, or at least for a really long time. We'll take a look at the origins and why we think these games have lasted the test of time. But first, a thank you to our Patreon friends of the show, Emil Jiljam, George Gia, and Adam Harrison. Also, a huge thank you to all of our other patrons as well.
Yeah. Can you tell that we've drank caffeine?
Oh, yeah. I just wanted
to announce. Some of us haven't.
I wanted to do a special George Gia because I met him in person at your bachelor party, Chris.
That's true.
So I just wanted to give him something extra. That's all.
All right. He'll send me an email like, I appreciate that something extra. Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. We have an announcement. We have a couple. I always just make up announcements, really. But
I was going to say, that sounded like a really important one, the way that you said it.
We don't. Oh. Well, it's kind of really important. It's our October giveaway. Because we did not announce it last week.
No, we didn't.
No, because I wanted to keep people in suspense, and I forgot. So, this month, I'm moving. It's moving month for Chris. In fact, when this podcast drops, I should have completed the move.
Wow.
And that means that I still have games that I need to get rid of, give away to the greater listening community. So this month's giveaway is it's a Home Depot box of games. So pretty much everything I can fit in that box, I'm just going to load it with games and then I'm going to ship it. Continental US and Canada, because it's going to be a big box. I don't know all of the games that are going to be in there yet. They are not going to be terrible games. They're going to be pretty good games.
Chris doesn't do terrible games.
I don't
games.
Do terrible games. I know that I'm going to put Munchkin, the board game, in there. I know that there's going to be at least two different D&D adventure system games, Castle Ravenloft, Temple of Elemental Evil. Also, Attention Span Games sent us a couple copies of Replicants, which we have not played yet, but one of these will be in this box as well. This looks really cool. It is a single, it's square cards, and it's about double the size of a normal deck of cards, but, shorter because it's square. Very small footprint, looks really cool. We just got them in today. We just opened them up and we want to play it. But we had committed to Time Stories, so...
Kitty. I would not let them off the hook. And now I think Josh is in I only want to play Time Stories.
Yes,
now.
It's so good. It's like a D&D light, but like choose your own adventure-y, and there's so much. I had such a great time.
Maybe we'll put the first expansion of Time Stories in there too. We'll see. Because Josh wants to borrow it. So
dare you. No, I want to borrow it first. That'll be another
giveaway.
We'll
just have to finish the one that we're playing now, and then we can give that one away because
once we go through the entire set, I can give Time Stories and all five of them. So maybe that'll be like January's giveaway, and that gives us a time
sounds
to
like
aim towards.
Yeah,
yeah. They'll have to trust us on reorganizing the cards, but
yeah.
Other than the bits are.
It'll be all good. We'll make sure everything's in good shape. So October though, random games. And again, Boxo it's going to be games. A big box of games. Deadline is November 3rd. That is a Friday. That will be the Friday of Game Hole Con,
yeah.
And we will announce it. We're not necessarily doing a live show at Game Hole Con. That's another announcement, Game Hole Con, first weekend of November, November 3rd, 4th, 5th. We're not going to do a live show, but Kitty and I will do a show from Game Hole Con. We'll likely have kind of the sound of the crowd in the background, but we'll probably just kind of talk about what we've seen, what we've played. We'll get to play with a lot of different people at Game Hole Con. We're teaching games. Josh will be in London.
I will.
But that's okay. Sydney will be there. Actually, Gloria mentioned that she might go.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, we'll see. So that should be fun. And so that's our contest. Again, November 3rd. How do you enter? You simply email us at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com.
There you go.
Thank God it isn't Yahoo.
The subject line, October giveaway. And that's really all you have to do except for give me your name. So first and last name would be fantastic. And a reminder that if you are international, I won't take you off the list. But if you win, you'll be paying about $200 in shipping. So it's totally up to you. But US or Canada, I got you covered. Kickstarters. I backed two, and then I'm going to remind her of one. First one I backed was Dino Genesis, and it's because of the subtitle, Dinosaur Park Management. This game...
It's actually Dinogenics.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
What I meant to say. What did I say?
Dinogenesis.
There you go.
Dinogenics, even way better. Dinogenics. This is basically Jurassic Park in a box. I love the little blurb here. Dinogenics is a worker placement game where players compete to build the most successful and profitable dinosaur park. Each player takes on the role of a multi-billion dollar corporation, each with access to their private island park for only $49. So that's the base game, $49. It looks really cool. And if you like Jurassic Park...
Things start to go wrong?
I hope so.
I really hope so.
Yeah.
Life finds a way.
Life does find a way. So yes, if you like Jurassic Park, check out this game. It's cool. I think there's about... Oh, I should know this. I didn't put it for either of these. But I think it's about a week left on it, maybe 2 weeks left. So it's not like right away around the corner, but it's within the week. The other one I backed was Tiny Epic Defenders, which this is the second in the line of Tiny Epic games, actually both in truth and in Kickstarter restarts, buying the same game twice. So I already own Tiny Epic Defenders. This is Tiny Epic Defenders second edition with the Dark War expansion. Full disclosure, I did not like Tiny Epic Defenders. It's a co-op game, and it just kind of fell flat for me. But looking at what they added with the expansion, and they added item meeples that they have in like Tiny Epic Quest into the game, so now I can run around and like put little items on my meeples, I had to back it.
You sound so addicted right now. There's this game that I really fell flat for me. I didn't really like it, so I bought the expansion, obviously.
Maybe it'll fix it.
It's true. It might. So, you're going to have to let our listeners know if it does.
Well, the expansion adds campaign mode.
Okay.
So if there's a campaign mode, then it adds a little bit something more to it. Like I say, the game itself wasn't that. It was just kind of like ho-hum. There wasn't a lot to do.
Right.
Much like Pandemic is kind of a pandemic game. But yeah. Pandemic Legacy, campaign mode, super fun.
That's true. Yeah.
So
you won me over.
Yep. And Tiny Epic Defenders is the co-op version in the line. So it's like each Tiny Epic Defenders is a different sort of mini genre.
Ah.
So.
Am I just an enabler?
Yes.
No, it's fine. It's nice when someone changes their mind.
Kitty's dangerous because when we both go someplace, we enable each other without knowing.
We do so bad.
It's not even on purpose. So, yeah, so this one, the base game and the expansion together is $46. If you just want the expansion, it's a little cheaper. They also have a $41 level. If you already own the game, you can back it at $41 instead of $46, but they may require evidence that you already own the game. So if you Kickstarted in the past or something like that, they're like, oh, yeah, no, we got it. Otherwise, you have to send them a picture with your face in a newspaper or something. I don't know.
Wow. You really are on caffeine today.
I had coffee. So, but yeah, but I just backed at $46 because they're like, oh, I don't want to send my picture. I don't know why I do that stuff. Besides, I like supporting them. I love this company. And my final one is I want to remind everyone, the Seventh Continent is this choose-your-own-adventure sprawling board game. I've been watching some more videos on it. Apparently, the biggest complaint is it's really long. Like the first game can take anywhere from 5 to 30 hours, depending on the review you watch. Now, there's a save mechanic in it. So it's like the box says you can save it in 30 seconds and then reset it in 30 seconds. So you just kind of gather the cards, put them in a certain order, and then you put them back out and you can start again. But it's like this sprawling world that you're exploring. And there are different curses, and each curse is like a different, not necessarily campaign, but path and something you have to figure out, but you're doing it in the same world. This game is right now the hotness. It's probably going to win the 2017 mini games.
Oh, mini games. I was going to say, haven't you said this about 5 different games?
No. Oh, this one, I mean, this is like the huge game right now. I don't know where Gloomhaven falls in this because they came out at the beginning.
What was the other game that you said was super hot? I think it was like last week or the week before.
No, this is the same game.
Oh, it's the same
one. Okay. I'm mentioning this one again. Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to be able to get this in retail.
Right.
So they are only doing Kickstarter only for this. So if this is something that you think you want to choose your own adventure type of card, it's just look into it because you're not going to get it anyplace else.
I'm going to go around your place and play it at your house.
Well, I'm already going to buy two copies so that when it does come out and we have new listeners, that will be the giveaway for that month.
Oh, listeners are going to be salivating at the thought, of course.
It's just the way that works. Yeah. I need to keep the listeners salivating.
I agree. However, good work.
Yeah. Let's move on quick. So last week, actually, no, Josh, you do the whole segue thing.
Oh, segue, yes. Well, let's get some feedback about past episodes. And if you have feedback about this or any of our previous episodes, email us or go to our Board Game Geek forums, easily found at tabletopgametalk.com/BGG.
Yeah, so last week I forgot to put the input thread up. So
we sure did.
Now we have output from the input thread for feedback.
Nice.
So this feedback is about last episode.
Yes. Most of this is from the last episode. And our last episode was Fiddly Bits, which was a little fiddly, but I think it turned out all right.
It did. And Christy says, as for in-game fiddliness, I'm not a fan, but will deal with it if the game is good. Dead of Winter and Yokohama are good examples of games that are worth their profusions of small bits. Having your bits organized on the tabletop, muffin liners, component trays, etc., can make a positive difference. Upgraded custom bits can occasionally help, as 3D/realistic bits can be more visible and more tactile than a bunch of cardboard chits.
Yep, completely agree.
Yeah, and those silicone cupcake cups are amazing.
Yeah, and they're the same thing. Like, if you were to just rebrand those as fiddly bit components for games, you could sell it for 5 times the cost.
Like, and people do.
Christy also mentioned having 3D printed out dice holders for Gloomhaven. So you put the little monster figure in there, and then there's two dice that you put in there that shows their hit points. And then when you move them around, you can just glance at that particular monster, and you just modify the dice. I have not tried those. So Christy, please let us know how that turns out for you. She says she hasn't played with them yet, but you know she plans to in our next session. I'm not sure if they will be more or less fiddly, because you'll have to find the different size of the dice.
Yeah.
But at least once it's set up, at a glance, you can say, okay, that guy has 3 hit points left. I can take him out and move on from there.
All right. So we've got some feedback from Steve. Through the ages, a new story of civilization and terraforming Mars have huge problems with fiddly bits. That is why people buy overlays and things like that. Scythe is a great example of how you can have a player board full of stuff and not have to sit in terror every time somebody stands up from the table. I really dislike player boards that do not have a way to keep components from sliding around.
Yeah, especially if you're playing at like a kitchen table that's, when I was growing up, we had really wobbly kitchen tables.
Yeah.
Or a card table, and just a bump of that, even if there are no drinks on the table, suddenly the whole game is gone.
My mom's house is full of antiques, so anything you bump, it's like, whoa, there's an earthquake in the whole house. So,
Yep. Nope, I totally agree. And even Terraforming Mars is kind of fiddly. Actually, not kind of. It is as fiddly, because we were just talking Pandemic as being a very fiddly game. And it just has a lot of cubes. But Terraforming Mars also has all of these cubes. I think anything where you have like a ton of cubes automatically.
And cardboard tiles that all have to sit exactly next to each other in the right pattern.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. And then you have the cubes on top of the cardboard tiles. And you have a deck of cards that's like 160 deep that you have to try to shuffle because you're going through them like 3 or 4 times in a game. Yeah.
We need like a shuffling machine.
I need an intern. All right, Josh.
Oh, yes. Michael says, the first thing that comes to mind with this is Sentinels of the Multiverse. I love this game to death, but holy moly, is it fiddly. Setup can be a bit of a bear without good organization system to start as any card game like it can run into. But this isn't nearly as bad as others of its ilk, thankfully. The real problem, though, comes with all the markers and tokens. I give you +1 defense and the villain a -1 damage modifier. Oh, and what's that token for? Who put that there? Oh, you did, and it is to show he takes extra fire damage every turn. Okay, honestly, I haven't found a clean way of fixing this outside of the many apps that you can use to run that part of the game for you.
Yeah, and honestly, even the apps, the Sentinels of the Multiverse, I wanted to bring it up last week. I just forgot. Another friend of mine, Sarah, this game is what sparked me thinking of that episode, because watching her take care of all of the villain steps in this game, I'm like, I'm glad I'm not doing that. I just have to pay attention to my cards and I'm good. But Michael's right. All of the different bits, the plus ones, all the tokens, it's neat. It's like, oh, I can give you a plus one and I can get a minus one defense and I can add this here and I put that there. It's just, it's too much. It's too much in a board game to do that. I think of D&D. D&D 3rd edition and 4th edition, tons and tons and tons of modifiers all over the place. D&D 5th edition, you either have advantage or you have disadvantage. You roll two dice and take the higher of one or the lower of one, or you just roll one die for normal. They got rid of all of the pluses and minuses and all the micro counting in that, and the game is more fun because it's more streamlined. So board game designers out there, watch your fiddly bits. Not everything has to give some kind of unique modifier. A single mechanic can cover things in a lot of times, and just let the game be fun by itself. So let's see, a few others. Caleb mentioned using foam core inserts to help reduce setup and teardown time. Steve actually gave us a link on the BGG forum of where you can learn how to do that. We might do an episode. Christy actually mentioned that we could do an entire episode on like organizing games. And it surprised me that we haven't done one yet. So I think we should.
Didn't we do?
I feel like we did.
You did one about organizing something. No, it was about the bits, the design of the bits. Oh, I can't remember what it was like.
Well, I know that I did some podcasts on...
You keep going.
Reboxing. Also, foam core just sounds like a really cool fashion.
Keep walking.
Yeah, I need to. Yeah, I want to figure out how to do that. All right.
Man, I'm tired. Let's keep going.
Aaron agrees that Pandemic is one of the most fiddly games. Aaron, I promise you there's a ton more fiddly games, but I will agree there's a lot going on in Pandemic.
There's just so many cubes.
There's a lot going on there.
Michael, all the cards.
Yeah.
There's so many cards.
Yeah. Michael also mentions Dragon and Flagon as a fiddly game. I listened to the Ludology podcast, who's Jeff Ingolstein is the designer of Dragon's Fantasy. He talks about it quite a bit. And one of the things he mentions is when they're playing it, they don't even keep score. They just play the game, and however it ends, it just ends. But I have not yet. I bought it. I own it. I haven't played it yet. It's super tactile, three-dimensional guys running around a bar, having a bar fight. But
you
it does
excited
have
excited when you got that game.
I know, and I really want to play it. But when I opened it up, there was so many fiddly bits. Ah. I'm like, need to be in the right mindset to be able to teach this game. So I'm like, okay, we'll wait on this one a little bit. But it has an interesting action time track. So when you take an action, depending on how long that action would take, that's where you move on the time track. So if it takes you 5 units, you move up 5 units. And the person who goes next is the person that's furthest back in the time track. So if you do like 3 or 4 little things before you hit the next person's time marker, you can take 3 or 4 little turns in a row. So I kind of like that idea. But again, it does add fiddliness. So what have you discovered?
We didn't do one specifically on organizing games, but I feel like we talked a lot about it in tricking out your games.
Probably.
That was what I was thinking of, tricking out games.
Yeah. All right. I still think we should do one on organizing games because it's one of my favorite things to do.
It lends itself well to our YouTube relaunch.
It does. Well, maybe we'll do a Simo relaunch.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of which, the YouTube relaunch will happen eventually, not in October. October is crazy month for Chris.
Probably not in
November
either. November or December. And I'm not going to be there in January. So,
all right. Yeah. So it will happen though. My gaming table is supposed to come in January, February. So that'll be a good thing. I will post some pictures of the new game room once it's unpacked and there's actually games on the shelves. So Terrence asked for, hey, post a picture of the game room. I'm like, well, right now there's only 3 games on the shelf, but it is the first thing that we moved into the house. We have not moved the rest yet. Actually, hopefully by the time you hear this, because if it's true when you hear this, that's a sad, sad world. we have one more, and this one's a little bit more. Don't worry, it ends okay. But this is from Rusty. Rusty I met at Dice Tower Con, and I played Sea of Plunder. This is a new game that he's been working on. And he lives in Indiana, but he came up to Protospiel in Chicago a while back. Actually, well, Sydney and I were in Grand Con. Protospiel is a place where you can bring prototypes and just get feedback. He sent me an email, though. It says, I made it to Protospiel Chicago and played one game before I got a phone call from my wife. She had thought something was wrong. Remember, they are expecting twin boys. And when she went in to get checked, they noticed that the babies had experienced twin-to-twin transfusions. One was receiving too much blood and was starting to show signs of congestive heart failure. They took her in to have emergency surgery inside the womb. It was then that he received a call and began a 7.5-hour drive from northern Chicago to Cincinnati. Both babies are fine. Wife is doing well. One baby's heart is still needs time to heal, and they're only 22 weeks along. The surgery, so they're a long, long way to go. But
18 more weeks,
18
hopefully.
More weeks.
And, fingers crossed, 18 weeks. That's a full term.
Yeah. And his wife has to be in the hospital until the twins arrive. So what he was asking is if we knew any good two-player games. And what I'm going to do is put a call out to the listeners as well. So this is the requirements. We've already sent them a couple games. But what we need are two-player games that will play on a like a hospital table. So relatively small footprint.
Small footprint-ish.
Easy setup, not too convoluted, and fun. Also, Kitty mentioned like having a single-player version. So.
Yeah. So the game I sent along already is Herbaceous. I think we gave it like a really brief mention a couple episodes ago. It was a random pickup at the store for me, and it plays 1 to 4 players. So you can play solo, you can play it head-to-head, or you can play up to 4 players. So, you know, if they've got people visiting, it's a good flexible game. But I can just imagine sitting in a hospital room staring at the you have to have 2 people game, like...
Yeah.
Being all alone.
I can't play any of these games.
Yeah. So games with solo variants, I think, would be fun.
We're just looking
too.
For recommendations. Is that right?
Yeah. Looking for recommendations.
Nice.
Like a two-player, two-player solo or smaller footprint, larger.
Do you send them Herbaceous and something else?
I'm going to send them a bunch of other games too. So I have a bunch of small box games that I think will work well for the hospital. But yeah, so if any of our listeners have suggestions or if you've been in a similar situations and, you know, this is how you guys played games.
Let us know.
Let us know. All right. That is about enough of off topic. Let's do other things, Josh. Wait, I have to press this button.
In this episode, we're talking about ancient games, chess, checkers, Mancala, Go, backgammon, and others. Nearly everyone has played or at least heard of these games. Some have been around for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. But why?
Which is a good question.
It is a good question.
So what we did is we split this up and each of us had homework. And we researched a couple ancient games.
Guess who didn't do their homework this time?
It was Chris.
What?
It was Chris.
Okay, but I postponed the podcast and we played a game while I did my homework. So now I'm all caught up.
That's yeah.
Just very good, Chris. He was giving us so much jip about the fact that he thought we weren't going to do our homework. And he was, oh, I tell you.
So,
Iota.
Iota. I find these games fascinating. And of the ones we mentioned and basically the ones we'll talk about, and I think if you kind of look back, most of these games are two-player games. You guys kind of notice that?
Yep.
That's true.
And most of them have no randomness in it. But Kitty has all the random research, so she might have a skewed opinion of that.
I do.
But if you look at, you know, chess, checkers, Go, that's all head-to-head, and it's purely I move, you move, I move, you move. And those games seem to be, like, all over the world. Like, I thought it's like one place was going to be where all these games came from. No, they come from everywhere. So who wants to go first?
I'll jump in with checkers, or if you're from the UK, you call it drafts.
Really?
Yes. Drafts, as it's known as eight in Great Britain.
Eight in Great?
Yes. It has ancient roots. Yes. Apparently, right, they found in an archaeological dig in Ur, in Iraq, carbon dating, it was 3,000 BC. This is the first board that they found. But it was like a variant. There's been like a lot of... kind of evolving over time,
right.
But it was pretty similar to the game that we see today. So yeah, there's been a number of different sort of revisions, and ancient Egypt had its own version, and they had a 5x5 board. And then it wasn't, I think, until roughly about the sort of 1100s to kind of all the way up to the 1500s that they started to get much closer to the exact rules that we see today. They added, you know, the chessboard, the 8x8, and they also did the jumping moves, was the French revision at around the sort of 1500 mark, was to make it more challenging. Now, the interesting thing I think about checkers is that essentially it's become a solved game, which is crazy to me.
Yeah.
It's basically like with the advent of computers, they were able to game out the best way to play. And you, if both sides play perfectly, it will always end in a draw.
It's basically tic-tac-toe.
On a larger scale.
On a larger scale.
Yeah, which is crazy. But
more squares.
Yeah.
Really, yeah.
But there was some drama in the 90s because, and I hadn't heard of this before, but apparently there was sort of like a Deep Blue-esque thing. I'm sure people have heard of Deep Blue taking on Kasparov.
Yeah.
Well, in the 92, there was a guy called Tinsley who was like, he was so dominant in checkers, like more so than Kasparov ever was in his sport. And he'd never lost a match in a long, long time. And along comes this team head by a guy called Schaefer. And they'd spent, you know, years perfecting this machine. And they were like, okay, we're gonna play Tinsley. And, you know, Tinsley's having dreams the night before that God had spoken to him and saying that, you know, I like the computer people too. And he was worried about it. And they were going to have 30 matches over the next 2 weeks.
That sounds excruciating. I can't play 30 matches of checkers.
I mean, this was like the number one checkers person ever.
Okay.
And
he probably likes checkers more than I do.
Yeah, right? And so it was a real like hype top as like man versus machine, you know, like who will prevail? And then basically they started to play and they had 6 games and they were all draws. And Tinsley started to feel not well, like physically not well. And it wasn't anything to do with the fact that he was, you know, being challenged. He was quite excited to play this machine because he hadn't been really challenged by any other human for a long time. But he went to the doctor and he had like a lump on his pancreas. So he had to withdraw from the match. And a few months later, I think 7 months, he died of pancreatic cancer.
This is a terrible story.
I know, it's very sad. It's very sad. But Schaefer, who had designed the machine, was kind of like, stricken, not only because, you know, he'd become friends with Tinsley, but also, you know, as the years went on, people were saying to him, well, your machine would never have been Tinsley. So he then wanted to create the perfect machine that would game out the game of checkers to the point where it was solved so that he could always say, well, a human is always going to be close to perfect, but never perfectly perfect like a machine would be. And so it took him many years afterwards, 13 years to be in fact, until 2007 when they managed to complete it and say, yes, we have solved checkers.
So checkers is no longer a game that anyone needs to play.
That's a very cynical view, Chris.
Well, it actually brings up, like, anything that doesn't have randomness has the potential of being solved.
Yep.
We've talked about that with some Euro games where there's no randomness. So it's one of those things where you kind of take the risk of having a game that's solvable. Now, if you have a solvable set or a set that's so big that it doesn't matter because no one can really game it out that far, then you're okay. Like chess sort of falls into this realm. It's something that's very close to being solved, but still there's so many different ways that you can play it. We'll get to that in a second. But checkers is relatively straightforward, you know.
So, it always looked a bit boring to me just from looking at it. I mean, I played a few games when I was younger, but I never really got into it. I was more into chess. But, you know, it's kind of interesting to hear this history. You know, I had no idea it was that old, you know, like 1000 BC or whatever. Yeah. Ooh, Jesus.
Fun fact, one of the first games I wrote for and got paid for, like professional games, was 2 versions of checkers. One of them had frogs and one of them had spaceships. And the frogs one, the AI in it, was a completely random number generator. It would just, I had taken artificial intelligence classes and I made the game, you know, look forward, black, red, cheese, and, you know, all that stuff. But it was way too hard because we were making a casual game. So I just changed the AI to a random number generator. And my boss comes in and he's playing. He's like, no, this is good. Wow, this is kind of hard, but this is good. I'm like, And then it forced him into a situation where he had to take a jump because one of the rules of checkers is if you can jump, you must.
Mm-hmm.
And what it did is it set him up because that's really the only way to set someone up in checkers is you force them to get into a situation.
Mm-hmm.
It set him up and again, all randomly. And he like lost a king or something like that because he had to jump and then he lost his king. So he got really mad. He's like, no, that's a stupid rule. We're not putting that in there. Like, it's the rules of checkers. Tell you what. For the frog version, I'll make it so you don't have to jump. But for the spaceship version, we'll make that one a little bit harder so you have to follow the rules.
The frog one, you didn't have to jump. Where frogs always jump.
That's their thing.
Ridiculous.
But Chris. Frogs have the option to jump or not. UFOs, they just want to blow everything up.
You should change the animal to sloths or something. Frogs are the wrong
It was kind of cute. They were jumping a little lily pad.
Well, they weren't jumping, were they?
Well, not if you didn't want to. So, but yeah, it's interesting. I like checkers. I wouldn't play it with anyone above the age of 7. Right.
It's a really fun, I've got an app that it's a 2-player app, so you can play against another actual human. So it's a fun one for the airport.
It's light.
Stuck with someone else. Yeah. But yeah, it's
you're
not
stuck
something.
With someone else. Yeah. And you don't want to talk to them, yeah?
Well, let's.
Well, no, like me and Spencer get stuck at airports quite a bit.
Right.
And you know, like, yeah, we could talk, we could watch something, but you know, you want to play a game and we didn't plan ahead ever, so we don't have games on us. So
yeah, that's true.
Whatever's on my phone, it's either Hangman or checkers usually.
Yeah. And well, it's one of those things that everyone knows how to play. You can pull it out. Yep. I mean, most of these games are that. So let's segue checkers and chess.
Yes.
You hear that all the time. So chess started out really, it's about 1500 years old. So somewhere 500-ish. And it originated in northern India. So, and in the 6th century, it spread to Persia. And then Persia was conquered by the Arabs. And then it was taken into the Muslim world. And subsequently, the Moorish conquest of Spain, then spread it to southern Europe. Now, I will admit that many of these countries and wars and conquests, I have no idea. Got that from Wikipedia. But what the point of it is, it eventually made its way to Europe. And in the 15th century, that's where the pieces and the moves that we see today come from. And that's why when I think of chess, you know, rooks and kings and bishops and knights, I think Europe, because that's just where that kind of all originated. So it did pass through Europe, and that's where it became more and more popular.
Did they reskin it?
They reskinned it. Yeah. Well, I think that's sort of the thing that I've noticed with a lot of these things. They've been reskinned over time. And eventually what we see today is something that's only a few hundred years old. But if you keep tracing back, you can see how even these games kind of like iterated and gotten better and more streamlined and more codified and like a rule set. It was the second half of the 19th century that tournaments started. And then in 1997, Deep Blue beat the first chess world champion. So this is the first time where a computer beat a human playing chess. And now
I remember that.
It was a big deal.
It was a huge deal. I was kind of upset
20 years ago.
Wow.
Now it's, you know, you're never beating a computer in chess anymore.
Sure.
It's not happening.
Unless you teach the computer how to be dumb.
Well, and that's sort of the point. So the massive AIs for chess, like the ones that are grandmaster level, they're doing really, really well.
Yeah.
You normally, if you're playing a game, you're playing against a computer, you're playing with I don't want to say disadvantaged AI, it's just a different AI. I could do an entire.
I want to say that the you know, the top players now will often train with AIs because obviously they're better than real people. So,
But the thing with AIs, as I don't want to get too much into this, but I think it's number one, AI, artificial intelligence. We also look at ML, which is machine learning, and they're a little bit different.
Right.
Traditional AI, especially of like the 90s and earlier, even early 2000s, were heuristic based artificial intelligence. Or brute force based. I know, I'm going to be real quick. So it was essentially a set of rules, and the computer would either say, my best move is this, your best move is this, and it would go back and forth and play like 5 or 6 moves ahead. And it would pick the best one based on an assumption that you're going to do something good. So you can kind of game that kind of AI. That's no pun intended. But now they're actually using machine learning and neural networks to do it. So the AIs are starting to think more like people would think. And you can't really be predictive.
Well, they essentially teach themselves, right, how to do better moves to the point where it's not even like the people who made the machine aren't teaching it. It's just it knows how to teach itself.
Yeah,
playing lots of games.
It plays itself is what happens.
Right.
So they just play each other. I won. Okay, so these games are good. Oh, I lost, so I need to adjust that. And they just keep playing each other and getting better and better.
Right.
So chess, I think this is probably the most popular of the ancient games.
I agree.
I can't.
It probably depends also which part of the world you're from. I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But maybe, who knows? Maybe chess.
Maybe like Western cultures. I don't know if Asian cultures.
I don't know.
Because, I know Go is obviously a big one. I want to say that that's bigger in Asia than it is here.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Backgammon goes through waves of popularity, apparently.
Yeah, well, let's go to that,
We can talk about it, yeah. So backgammon is a combination strategy and luck game. So it is the only one of these games, I believe, that involves dice, except we will talk more about dice later. So it's a board with 12 points, 60 checkers, and depending on where you are in time and rules, 2 to 3 dice. There are excavations in Iran that have found a game like this as early as 2800 BC.
That's like 5,000 years ago.
Yes. It's like 5,000 years old. And there are, records from the Roman and the Byzantine Empire, like, that the rules haven't actually changed very much since then.
Wow, that's crazy.
It's played fairly similar to the point where there's, I can't remember the emperor's name, but the emperor lost a game and he was very angry at the dice, and like they can still describe his strategy and what the dice had, like the move that he had to make that ruined his game, and it still makes total sense to us reading it by thousands of years later.
That's even better than checkers and chess, which we just, has the rules have changed quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is the one where the rules have remained fairly static. So, and it moves to France during the 11th century. And this is always a game that's associated with gambling.
Because there's dice.
Dice, gambling, they go hand in hand. It was actually outlawed in the 1500s in Elizabethan England.
Which made it more popular.
Of course. That's the only way. Just as soon as you ban something. Yeah, completely.
But in England by the 18th century, they'd gotten over that. So there are books published about, how to play backgammon strategy, all that kind of stuff. There's one by Edmund Hoyle, which is very famous, from 1753.
And also the writer of a ton of card games, isn't it?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. So it kind of goes through waves of popularity. It was dwindling into the 20s, the 1920s. So they added a concept of doubling. So when you think of like double or nothing, that was brought to backgammon. And there's tons and tons of betting on backgammon then. And then it went through another surge of popularity in the 60s. There's basically one guy whose name I did not write down because I'm bad at my homework, Chris, who was like the grandfather of modern backgammon, who brought it back into popularity. And like they used to play it at the Playboy Mansion, and it was like a huge thing in the 60s.
I used to play it. Well, I didn't play it in the 60s, but I played this with my mother all the time.
Yeah, my mother really liked it as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it stayed, okay popularity throughout the mid-70s and then has kind of dwindled. And now the only reason people have heard of it now is because it was featured heavily on Lost.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say backgammon's not one of those games that I hear a lot about these days.
No.
That's true.
Now, you can still walk into, I want to say, I can't even think that I've seen it in a game store. There are department stores and things like that, like a Sears or something, that you could definitely find it in.
I want to say it also normally comes in those sets of like old games like this. Like sometimes you'll get like, you get chess and checkers, and backgammon is normally one of them, and then maybe a couple more, like all in one set.
It's often when you have to like unfold the board.
Yes.
On one side, there's the chess checkers board. On the other side, there's the backgammon.
Yep.
Oh, right. Yep.
Because aren't the pieces for backgammon very similar to checkers?
Basically checkers.
Right, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. That makes sense.
They're actually called checkers.
Oh, yep. There we go.
Mm-hmm. All right, Josh, what was your other game?
So, Mancala. Which, to be honest, when you said it last week, when you were telling me what my homework was, I was like, what's that? And then when you actually see the board, you're like, oh, it's that game. So basically, the board is very simple. It's essentially just like hollowed out cups or holes that will hold little pebbles or seeds, they're normally called. And the idea is that it's kind of like, it's under the umbrella of sowing games, they call them. It's designed like sowing seeds into these little holes that would be, because these were originally played in just in dirt holes. And it's a very, very ancient game. And there's tons and tons of variants. So I think more than 800 games, Mancala type games, are to be known over 99 countries. But yeah, I mean, it's extremely old. Goes back into the BCs. Some people say it's possibly the oldest game because you didn't really need much to play it with. Like I said before, you could scoop out holes in the dirt and then you just find little pebbles or rocks as the seed pieces. And you're basically picking up a bunch of the seeds in from one of the things, and then you put one in each hole going around until you have no seeds left. And there's different rules about when you can then capture some of the seeds, because the idea is that you sow and then you capture. And if you end on a cup holder that has a certain amount in, you know, for a lot of these games, then you get to keep some and you've got to get the most seeds. So yeah, it's extremely old. You know, there's these, some variants are massive. Like they had like ones that like 400 holes and they're like, you know, 40 by 5 or something. And they're just absolutely ginormous things, and then they have like small mini versions. So it really has all these tons of things, but a lot of it was kind of focused and began in Africa. So there's some interesting boards out there, some with like kind of very decorative. We've got some sort of flamingo looking board here. But yeah, it's a game I haven't played much, I've got to be honest. I mean, have you guys ever played Mancala?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yep. I'm not sure I played it in person. I just played it with an app.
I believe we bought a set from the Field Museum when we were there visiting one time. I was maybe like 9, 10, and my family all played it for a while. It was kind of like our obsession for a bit.
Yep.
Until we all could actually beat each other pretty reliably and got to be less fun for us.
Yep. My friend Irene, she would had it on her phone, and whenever her and her now husband would travel, they would, you know, play Mancala. That's their checkers.
Yep.
It says that's here. It says here that some people would even play with dung balls.
Sure.
Lovely. Yeah. Of course.
Why wouldn't you?
If you're in rural places, why? Yeah,
make
why
a not? Game of it.
Yeah.
It's yeah. I just think it's really cool. I never really thought of it, but yeah, you can literally play this anywhere.
Yeah.
You need some stones and I mean
holes.
And some holes.
Yeah.
You know,
and actually some bits and some holes. They don't have to be the same thing. There's not like a lot of times you'll see like two different colors, but that's just for aesthetics. All the pieces are the same. I think you start with a certain number
in each small hole. And usually there's two large holes that are empty and you're trying to capture the pieces into your side large hole. Yeah.
But the large hole isn't counted when you're dropping pebbles, or is it counted?
It is.
Okay. So you drop a pebble there, and anytime a pebble goes there, that's your keep.
And then if you land in an empty opposite one, you get to capture those and they go into your pit.
Interesting. Yeah. Like I said, I'll just let the computer take care of the rules for me. But that's so cool.
Yeah. I wouldn't quote me on those rules even. That's a vague memory.
It's been recorded, so too late.
There's lots of variants, so I'm sure that's one of them.
Yeah, it's probably a variant.
Yeah, it's my variant, Chris.
All right, so now I'm going to talk about Go, which I think is a game that everyone's heard of, and very, very few people actually know how to play.
Yeah.
You're either like a Go player, or you're like, huh? So... And there's a lot of variants to this one as well. As far as we can tell, it's thought to be somewhere between 2,500 and 4,000 years old. And in fact, they think that the first boards were kind of early attempts at abacuses. Essentially a grid of dots is the board. Some boards will have like connecting lines between the dots, but the lines don't really mean anything. It's the orthogonal dots, orthogonal? Dots, the up, down, left, right dots.
But they're in a grid of squares, right?
Right. Yeah. So it's what's the one where you connect the dot and make squares?
There's a game called Squares, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it's squares. You draw lines. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but we're basically just start with a set of dots.
Yep.
But we put a dot on one, and you can put these pieces. I play one color, you play another color, traditionally black and white. And you just go back and forth placing a single dot. And the idea is you're trying to capture areas that your opponent can't take back. So if I'm surrounding your piece on all four sides, that piece is removed from the board. And I now control that spot, because if you were to put a piece there, it would just immediately be captured by me because I'm all around. Now, those areas can get bigger and bigger. And there's sometimes you can take over the regions from the inside. depending on where the dots are and whether or not you can surround other people, and diagonals are like having a kind of step ladder, you know, strategy. Those types of things can help you gain territory. I can play the game. I still need the computer to score the game for me and to tell me if I have areas. But this thing's been around. So my favorite is that Confucius wrote about it in like 4 and 500 BC or 4 and 300 BC.
Oh, yeah.
In the 1600s, Japan actually created four Go schools where it was they studied Go. And every year, the top person from each of those schools would compete. And it was kind of like the Triwizard Cup of Hogwarts. You know, it was like, get together. Well, I guess Hogwarts Quidditch would be a better name of the four houses. But still, Triwizard Cup, get together. Triwizard?
Triwizard Tournament is what you're looking for?
That's what I'm looking for.
There you go.
Just imagine they were just playing Go instead. Not nearly as exciting.
I was going to say, are there dragons too while they play Go?
Aren't, but maybe as a pattern on the board, there could be. And then 1978, a professional system was established for Go. And now you have handicaps. And so there is a first player advantage to Go. So you normally get a half point if you're going second. And that's sort of just the tiebreaker because you count points by the number of your pieces on the board and the number of squares that you own. So if you go second, you get a little bit of a bump for that half point. So that was kind of codified in the late 70s. That's when the Japan-China Super Go series started in the late 70s.
All right.
Is actually kind of uncommon for people to compete outside of their own country. But in the 70s, again, apparently the 70s were all about Go. There's $1 million, I think it still exists today, a top prize of $1 million for the Go World Champion each year.
Wow.
So that draws a few people in. And then just recently, AlphaGo.
Oh, yeah. This is the bit I've been waiting for.
Yep. Defeats the Chinese master. Players have praised the technology's ability to make unorthodox moves and challenge assumptions core to a game that draws on thousands of years of tradition. So one of the things that can happen with these games, and chess has the same thing, mm-hmm. is you make assumptions about what you should do next. When you're learning chess, one of the first things you're studying as becoming a chess master is opening positions, opening moves.
In the Go, scholars open.
Exactly.
And whatnot.
Yep. Go has the same thing. You do certain things and you defend sort in certain
by
ways.
The book ways to play.
Yep. So if you're playing that way and you're playing against someone good, like most of the time that's going to work because that's what each of you are expecting.
Yep.
So when Go made this move, I mean, the AlphaGo, yep, made this move. It was like the move heard around the world. It essentially was the computer placed a piece, and often a place that wasn't contested, just boop, in the middle of nowhere. And everyone's like, what just happened?
Did it have a bug? Did it make a mistake? Yeah, looks like a stupid move.
And then if you watch the game from that point on, from that move on, the computer had it. Like,
right.
Nobody saw that move as a viable, like that shouldn't work.
So it's opening up new avenues of play for the human people because they're like, oh, we can do stuff like this. We didn't even know you could do things like that.
Yep.
Wow.
And Go is one of those things with a problem space that's so big because you can actually just the board size. I believe there's a standard board size for tournament play, which I believe is 13 by 13. Don't quote me on that. But if you're starting Go, you're usually playing on like a 6 by 6 board. Mm-hmm. So a much smaller space. But if you imagine 13 by 13.
That's a very large grid.
Yes. And pieces get removed at different times and captured at different times. And the number of options you have. So if you think about it, in a 13 by 13 grid, let's do a 12 by 12 because I know that's 144. So that's how many moves you have at the beginning. The next person has 143 different places. Again, this is on a 12 by 12.
Yep.
Times 142, times 141, times 140. And you multiply all the way down until the game ends. And there's usually no moves left at the end, but there's spaces that may be left. That is a huge number that is in the... calculator is going to calculate it.
Yes, it does. It's a factorial, yeah, isn't
do 13
it?
Times 13 factorial, and your computer's going to be like, error. Maybe it won't. I don't know. The iPhone's pretty smart, but it's going to be rounded off to
Chris
something.
Chris is our Apple fandom.
I'm excited. I want to see what this is.
Well, we were doing 12. Smart.
Yeah. So if you do 144 factorial, that will give you not even close to the set.
I want to say that you're not necessarily right about that. You just times those numbers and that's it.
Yeah, just gave me
like,
an error.
I want to say there's more to it than that. Because there's more, I don't know.
There's not really, because you can put a piece anywhere on the board. So any place there's not already a piece. So if you have, again, 12 by 12 board, because 13 by 13 is 169. So there's 169 places I can put my first piece.
Right.
How many places can you put your first piece?
Yeah, one less.
And then I'm two less than that. So you just keep multiplying that. Mm. Now, not all those pieces are good moves.
Yeah, of course.
By no means. But it's their potential moves.
Right.
So that's where you calculate.
That's the game space. Yeah.
And then if you look at chess only has 16 pieces. Mm. And they can only all move in a very specific place.
Yep.
So most chess pieces can only go maximum of eight different locations. Right. Maybe. Like you might be able to get a bishop or a queen
but
in a position where
it has queen
can have at most eight
directions. But you can go distance in those directions.
That's true.
But in any case, it's a much smaller set.
You have more pieces that do different things. I don't know.
Yes.
Maybe it's similar.
Right. But when you're looking at just the possible places those pieces could go.
Yeah, that's true.
It's much smaller. Yeah. And that's why 1997, chess was like, AI said, hey, I can do this. And I think AlphaGo was only a couple of years ago.
Yeah, maybe a year ago.
Yeah. So 20 years later, now we're able to solve Go.
Right.
20 years from now, we can solve the secrets of life. Speaking of the secrets of life, the most important thing that we researched, and we didn't talk about this. Kitty decided that she wanted to do this.
I'm excited about this.
Yeah.
So we're talking dice?
We're talking dice.
All right. So the earliest known set of dice was found as part of a backgammon set, or a backgammon-like game set from about 5,000 years ago. But they are, it's theorized that they came from knuckle bones, which was a method of divination or fortune telling, where you threw actual bones. And there's a certain ankle bone, from goat or sheep, I think both have this kind of, it's four sides that are flat and two rounded sides. So it always lands with one of the four sides up. So I started marking those four sides. And they would tell your fortune, the future, tell you what the weather's going to be, where to go hunt, that kind of stuff. Then they started squaring them off. And, of course, that led to gambling because that's what humans do. We turn fortune telling into gambling, turn the gods into ways to change money in hands.
I was thinking, like, it's a fascinating thought experiment. Like, I was imagining, like, other intelligent beings somewhere else in the galaxy, the universe. Like, the pure physics kind of dictates dice, because I think you were saying that dice have been invented in different places at different times independently.
Yes, dice do not come from one specific place. It's true that the oldest set was found in a certain place, but they can't trace from Mesopotamia, where dice were found first. They can't trace that also, you know, was how they got to China. They came to China faster than they would have traveled.
Right.
They were independently discovered by cultures kind of everywhere.
Yeah.
And almost always started by throwing bones of some kind.
Yeah. And I could just imagine some alien species somewhere, they would have dice and they would probably have boards. Like, you know, it's just the physics. Like, if you're going to play a game, like, eventually it's going to be fairly similar. And, I mean, you know, you think about all these, you know, fantastical alien worlds and something like Star Trek. It's always like strange, you know, bizarrely different things that you couldn't think of. But it's like, no, it might be quite similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just a thought.
I do want to add, do you have more on dice?
I have more on dice.
Keep going.
Yes. So, there are known dice gambling games that came from China, Egypt, and Rome, and many others. There's many biblical references to casting lots, which are thought to be a dice game. And something that I thought was very interesting was we know that six-sided die have been around for forever, but also that the 20-sided die has been around since ancient Rome, and it was used in gambling games.
And D&D.
Really funny, because gambling was illegal.
So they used 20-sided dice in Rome, invented them there.
To play illegal gambling games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we do have this theory. If you make it illegal, it'll become popular.
Absolutely.
Yep.
That's how that works.
All right, and that's all my information.
All right, so Michael added a couple things on backgammon. He says tables is the name of the family of games that backgammon comes out of, resembling each other in some forms of the game, can be tracked trace back to ancient Egypt. Mm-hmm. Senet was the game in Egypt. Actually, I thought Senet was something else completely.
But that was a political game. I have heard, back and forth on Senet is a racing game. And I heard it worked a little bit differently with some of the sources.
Because backgammon is kind of a racing game at heart.
It is. So there are so many. Yeah, tables or board.
Yep.
And that's where kind of like tabletop games or board games comes from. Backgammon. The name for backgammon is tables or board or joie de table in French, which is table game.
He says Mesopotamia. Said it in my head. The game was called the Royal Game of Ur. In Rome, it was tabula. All of these games closely resemble what we see today. He then goes on that Mahjong is still a very popular game today as, dominoes is also very sad. Now, Mahjong, I did not do the research on this. I heard that Mahjong was not as ancient, or at least not as we play it today, but I don't know.
I trust he might have done a cursory look.
A very cursory glance that said something around like in the hundreds of years ago, not the thousands of years ago.
Dominoes is also very old, also from China, but the more modern variants we play today didn't come around until the 1800s. It says he's spent some library time in the library poring over through history articles. Way better doing his homework than I was. I think knowing these older games helps us in modern game design, as it is where all games originally came from. His research was done trying to come up with some unique feeling games for use in role-playing games around the world, or like in the world. And Terrence mentioned, you know, when he heard about the subject, he thought about TAK, T-A-K. And this one is a fictional ancient game. And there's a lot of these games that are trying to capture that feel of a game that could have been around forever. Mm-hmm. And you have to study the old games to kind of come up with a new game that feels like it could be ancient.
Right.
You know, and I think that's kind of a cool idea. Mm. Did we ever look at Chinese checkers?
I did briefly. And essentially, it's just a marketing ploy. It's not an ancient game at all. And it's not even Chinese. It was German. And it was called like Sternhelmer or something. But then they brought it to America and they decided to call it Chinese checkers for some reason. Thought it'd sell better. Sounded exotic.
It was a huge swing in the 70s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I played it at my grandmother's house. Probably in the 70s, actually.
Yeah.
It's a cool looking game. It's a Star of David shape and lots of little pieces like move around.
Yeah. I wanted to bring it up because it's another one of those games that people think are, Chinese checkers. Yeah. No. Mm-mm.
Not an ancient
game.
That
was basically, I don't know if it was Milton Bradley or Hasbro or whatever. No, but
not quite.
It was not.
Early 20th century.
Yep. Steve mentions Shogi is one of the games that comes to mind for him. This is a Chinese version of chess, can be found all over Asia, presumably used to teach tactics and strategy to military commanders. Let's see, Michael, we talked, Samir. So this one's interesting. So his knowledge of ancient games outside of the ones that we've talked about come from India. So he grew up in an India household in New York, and many of the first games were Indian games that his parents brought over. Can't say how ancient they are, but they definitely go back a way. So he played Karom, K-A-R-R-O-M, which is a dexterity game that plays similar to pool, but with flat discs on wood instead of balls on felt. Ludo, kind of a Parcheesi-ish game, which is a basis for so many roll and move games like Trouble and Sorry. I think that one's a little more, well, I don't know Ludo. Maybe Parcheesi is based on Ludo, but I don't know how ancient Parcheesi is. We are Googling it. And Snakes and Ladders, which I always thought was just a variant of Chutes and Ladders, but which I think it is. But he says it's looked down on by many board gamers. It's also a pretty ancient roll and move game. Based on a history of gaming book I came across at some point, Snakes and Ladders is actually based on the ideas of life being driven by outside forces that lead to many literal ups and downs along the way to enlightenment.
Oh my God, that's so deep.
I know. Doesn't that just completely change everything you think about, like Chutes and Ladders and stuff?
Because
you have no control.
We have Snakes and Ladders.
Yeah, you have Snakes and Ladders.
As a British version, yeah.
Yeah, so that you have no control. Sometimes you're going to climb that ladder. Sometimes you're going to bottom out, but you're always going to get back up. Yeah. And eventually you make it to the end.
It's kind of a loop.
Someone does. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That changes everything.
Oh, God. Life's so meaningful now.
It is.
Thank you, Snakes and Ladders.
Anything more to say about Parcheesi?
So Ludo is based on Pachisi, which looks very similar to Parcheesi.
So maybe I just can't read.
Yeah. And it has an established history to the 16th century, but may go all the way to the 6th or 7th century.
Yeah. So I think it counts.
Sure.
All right. So I think that is Ancient Games. Like I say, a lot of these are two-player heads-up games. Until you add the dice, they're very, very much no random. They're the original Euro games.
Well, I think it's really interesting that the dice all go hand-in-hand with gambling the whole time, whereas the other ones, it's more of a strategy intellectual pursuit.
Yep.
So
yeah,
once you add randomness in, people are like, oh, let's throw some money at this.
Because you can get lucky.
Yep.
Yep. You don't, like, it's the great equalizer between skill is you throw some dice on it or any kind of randomizer.
I did read something that said because it is a combination of strategy and luck, that backgammon, the better player will win more on average, but you can't count on that. It's like poker.
Yep.
More than it is like chess.
Yep. And I think any board game that has a random element to it will have that element to it as well. If you are better, you are more likely to win, depending on how far you slide to the random side. Yep. You know, I've in the early episodes, I talked about left, right, center, which is a completely random game. There are no choices to be made by the players. So it's just whoever randomly gets lucky. But that's like the extreme luck side. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the extreme skill side, which is your chess go type of things. And then wherever you're in the middle, the closer you are to reducing the randomness, the more likely the better player is to win. And that is the challenge in most games we play today and a reason why we want to keep playing games. I was so close. If only that roll hadn't come up, or if only this hadn't happened, or only I drew the right card, I would have won. So let's play again. Mm-hmm. Because next time it's going to happen. And you get to blame something else besides, I can't beat Josh because he's just way better than I am.
Yeah.
Oh, bless you. That happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah. So thanks, everyone, for listening. If you want to follow us, we're on Facebook at Tabletop Game Talk Podcast. We're on Twitter at Tabletop Game TLK. And you can follow me at Game Master Chris. The Game Master Chris, I'm a little bit more active on, but I manage both accounts. Also, if you want to help us out, you can review us on iTunes. And if you want to become a patron, you can check out more on that at tabletopgametalk.com/Patreon, which is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. The biggest advantage there is, besides we say your name on the podcast because we love you, you also get free entries and auto entries into all of our contests. So if you just like, I don't want to email Chris anymore, I'm just going to, you know, throw $2 a month at him and he'll just automatically enter, that's how you make that happen.
Aren't all of our entries free, really?
They're all free, but not all automatic.
Yes. Automatic is the thing.
Automatic.
You're getting there. That's the perk.
Yes. The Patreon is automatic, but you do get extra entries depending on your level, because I couldn't come up with anything better. So I'm just saying. All right, Josh, take us out.
Well, indeed. Thanks for listening. And remember, we love your feedback. So consider emailing us with comments or questions at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com. Finally, a huge thank you to our patrons, Emil Gilljam, George, Adam Harrison, Sam from New York, Jason Strong, Terence Miltner, Stephen Sykes, Alex Brown, Michael Ohl, Josh Arntz, Trevor Olson, Brian Arnold, Sean P. Kelly, John Merkel, Daniel Shepard, C. Marie, Rudy Rudy Lou, Benjamin Heimowitz, Jerry Huang, Mike Smith, Stefan, the hero we deserve but not the one we need, Phillips, Calib O'Brien, Josh Lewis, Jennifer Engelbrecht, Justin Willard, Christopher Dong, Jason Marks, Jeremy Fisher, Carl Hammond, David Radke, Lance Morgan, Nick Quickstra, and David Sellers. Until next week, when we talk about filler games, keep playing games and having fun.
Good night. So did we come across any, like, 3 or 4 player ancient games?
I don't think so.
Oh, that sucks.
Except, you know, just straight up dice betting.
We should invent one and say that it's been around forever. We can make it popular.
Love it.